Tonight on Arena, the 32, a new anthology of Irish working class voices. And Paul McLoone asks, where do I begin with Roxy Music? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. 2 years ago, Kit Duval was speaking to us on the programme, telling us about a book she had just edited. It was called Common People, an anthology of working class writers. It was a collection containing British and Irish authors, including Lisa McInerney and Paul McVeigh. Now, Paul McVeigh has edited an entirely Irish anthology, a sister publication called The 32, featuring 16 emerging writers and 16 established names, including Aaron Lindsay, June Caldwell, Danielle McLaughlin and Kevin Barry. Joining me this evening to talk about this new publication is that editor, Paul McVeigh. Kit Duval is on the line as well. June Caldwell is with me here in studio, and I do believe Aaron Lindsay is she just down the corridor in another studio, I'm pretty certain. I'll start with you, Paul, to what extent was Kit Duval's anthology back a couple of years ago, Common People, an anthology of working class writers, did you just know then, I want to do this and I want to do it for the island of Ireland?
More or less, yes. I mean, I had been invited to contribute to that anthology, one of the only two Irish writers there, and the new Irish writers who were coming up couldn't apply to that one. It was all going through the sort of the English writer development agencies. So I had called Kit and said, you know, look, you know, what about us over here, you know? And I think also when the book had come out in Ireland, Kit had been going around at literary festivals and writers were saying, what about us, you know, can we have one? So on the phone with Kit, she was sort of like, well, if you want, you know, if there's one to be done, Paul McVeigh, you're the one to do it. So way off, because I've just done one and I need a bit of a rest, more or less.
Yeah, I'm sure it was going around, Kit, going around various literary festivals that you were asked, is there going to be an Irish one? I'm pretty certain it was probably a question I asked you on the night we spoke about Common People as well. Is there going to be an Irish one? Was it a great source of relief, a phew moment when Paul said he was going to do it?
It really was, actually. And I knew Paul was the best person to do it because he has such great contacts and he has just such a good feel for the whole issue anyway. So it was lovely to pass it over to him. And I cannot say what a fantastic job. I've been reading it today and it's absolutely brilliant. It's everything and every bit as good, if not better, than Common People.
Well, we'll come back to the similarities and the differences perhaps that you see later on. But Paul, I suppose the first thing that you had to establish, well, I think maybe I'm wrong, to define or to find out what constitutes a working class voice, was that something you decided or something that the contributors decided?
Well, I think essentially me, I guess. I mean, I asked writers that I either knew were working class or I suspected were at working class. I wasn't always right. Or some had been felt that they were no longer working class and felt that they couldn't participate. But those were the sort of established voices that I'm talking about. But they did an open call for the working class writers who were emerging. And, you know, I didn't want to say, you know, this is what working class is. There is no test, you know, for what makes you working class. And, you know, and I think if I had come up with my own rules, I'd have gotten a thorough beating, you know, by people for saying, well, who do you think you are coming up with your rules for what makes working class? So, I mean, I let people self-define, one, trusting that no one's going to lie about it, but also, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're working class, you know it, let me tell you. And if by some weird cushioned life that you've led that you didn't realize it, somebody else will tell you, or some barrier will be put in your way through life that will soon let you know that being working class you know, is what you are.
Now, the barrier aspect is perhaps one of the interesting aspects of that answer there that you give us. But Kit, you have a quite a broad church in your mind when it comes to working class, and it's not always defined in terms of, to put it simply, amounts of money.
No, absolutely, because there's a lot of gentry in the UK who live on next to nothing, but they're most definitely upper class or aristocracy in some places. So it's not just about the amount of money that comes into the household. It's definitely about your education. It's about where your parents came from, where they work. And just like Paul said, the best thing to do with issues of who and who isn't working class is to let people decide for themselves. It's very much a sense of something that never leaves you. I lead a quite middle-class life now, definitely, if you looked at it. But I would never say that I'm middle-class, because where I came from was most definitely a working-class, if not under working-class community. And those sorts of things that happen to you when you're young and what defines you, it never really leaves you. And I will be working-class, you know, till the day I die. That's just the way it is.
Interestingly enough, Erin Lindsay, your essay in the collection, Erin, kind of, you're asking yourself that question. In fact, did you find yourself wondering initially, I think you asked this directly in the essay, am I working class enough?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like, I mean, when I first saw the call out that Paul put out to look for working class writers, immediately I was like, oh, that's me. I'm definitely going to go for that. And when I was sitting down to try and think about what to write about, it started to become a bit more difficult to be like, can I really call myself this? Like, I mean, what constitutes? Is there a checkbox? Is there a list of things that I need to, a list of criteria that I need to meet in order to be considered working class? Like, it's a very awkward area, I think, even asking myself. I remember even asking my parents, I was like, do you think that we're working class? And like, they were like, I don't know. We don't think about it. Like, you know, we just get on with it. Like, we don't really think about whether we are or we aren't. So yeah, that was definitely, I felt like, because that was becoming such an issue for me and even trying to think about what to write about, I figured, well, I might as well just use this as the subject of the essay anyway and examine it and examine what I think about it. But I definitely like agree with Paul and Kit there in saying that even if you've had some kind of upbringing where you're not sure, someone else will tell you. And I've definitely had other people make it clear to me as well. So yeah.
I was going to ask you about that, because you I suppose what you give us in the essay is you detail growing up in Tala and mm-hmm. the life that you had growing up there, and in a very happy situation, very supportive parents and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But I think, am I right in presuming and taking from the essay that oftentimes when you told other people you were from Tala, dump, up went the barrier or up went some kind of judgment in front of you?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't ever, you know, so overt as like, you know, somebody to say like, oh God, like, you know, you're from Tala. It was never like that, but it was definitely a very subtle kind of feeling of, like you said, like a barrier would go up that they would immediately kind of make a snap judgment about you, even whether they were realizing they were doing it or not. Because like I mentioned in the book, like I, you know, my parents very much raised me and my brother with this sense of like learning and love of learning and love of like having these discussions about big issues and what was going on in the news and stuff. And I was very into school, very into like, you know, it was never a question for me that I was going to go to college. It was never a question for me that I was going to, you know, have a career and do whatever I liked. So when I was coming out of school and I started like branching outside of Tala and meeting other people, and you get this sense that other people don't think the same thing of you, it was definitely a bit of a shock to be like, oh, other people think that I can't do this. Whereas I had been raised with like, there was never any, you know, question as to whether I could do whatever I wanted. So it's definitely kind of grappling with other people's preconceptions of you is a big part of it, I think.
What about for you, June Caldwell, here in studio with me? Was it a question you asked yourself, or was it something that somebody else presented to you as a labelling or a judgment of you?
Well, actually, the residents of where I live did a good job of doing it for themselves, because they went about changing the name of the neighbourhood from Ballymun to Glasnevin North. Such was the urgency to rid itself of any kind of notion of being working class. And they claimed it was because we couldn't get jobs at the time, that you wouldn't get a job if you had Ballymun on your CV. So there was all those kinds of prejudices hanging around Irish society in the 70s and 80s, and they were very, very prevalent. But just to talk about that, I think it is about the impact of otherness. If you're made feel other, you're somehow made feel different, you know, and that can be anything from barriers that you think you're going to face, from not having the confidence, from not having, you know, pathways open to you in terms of a career that you may want. I mean, you're constantly that feeling of somebody just having a Doc Martin on your head all the time and pushing you down and telling you, you know, you really have notions to be thinking that you're capable of something like that. And it's just that feeling of not having the same amount of casino chips as other people, if you like, that when it comes to life and planning out your life.
Did that kind of that Doc Martin boot on your head or on your face, did it come predominantly from outside your own community, or was there some of it within your own community as well? Maybe somebody tugging at the back of your shirt saying, hey, stay down here, don't be going anywhere.
I think both. I think that growing up in an area that was really controversial, and Ballymun in the 70s was obviously very controversial for many reasons. And also outside of that, then the kind of prejudices that people apply to that, you know, I mean, we grew up in a housing estate that's just transformed now. It looks very, very middle class with the big fancy trees and all the extensions and the Velux windows and whatever else they've done to themselves over the years. But at the time, it wasn't. And there were very large families in the area, and it was mostly a working. Everybody worked in whatever, in trades or civil service or whatever else. It wasn't an area that was kind of coming down with unemployment or anything like that. And we were made feel that the others out in the flats were way worse, and that you didn't mix and mingle with people from the flats, that you had to keep away from that element in your own neighbourhood. So there was a ridiculous amount of prejudice overall.
Kate Duval, your anthology of a couple of years ago, that title that you gave it, Common People, an anthology of working class writers. I suppose the term common people is a much more loaded term. Common, at any rate, is a much more loaded term in British society.
Oh, absolutely, yes. To be common is absolutely one of the worst things that you can be. It's vulgar, it's low, it's not how to behave. And it's certainly a phrase that me as a working class person and lots of other working class people I know have reclaimed. I'm very happy to be a common person. And, you know, have that in common with most of the UK. And let's never forget that most of the UK is working class, even though most of the UK is also aspirational middle class, because the working class in the UK is definitely seen to be something that you should get out of. And what we wanted to do with Common People is make a celebration of being working class, and to say that actually the solidarity and the friendships and the togetherness and the rituals and rights that we have as working class people is valuable and valid and not something to be got away from. So that's one of the things we wanted to show with the anthology.
And Paul, then when you name an anthology 32, and don't go telling me it's because there's 32 writers in it, when you do that in a country like Ireland, on an island like Ireland, where the number 32 has a very specific political content, you must have been very aware of giving it that number.
Well, I have no idea what you're talking about. I just added the number of people in the book, and well, it's an all island endeavour, you know. So that was definitely from the offset, and we knew we couldn't call it Common People, just having the same resonances here. And I kind of thought, was I being a wee bit cheeky, Sean? Yes.
But are you from Belfast? Yes.
Well, do you know what I'm saying? You know, and and I can say that now because the book's out. And I've done it now, so I can. No one's going to boycott it or anything like that. But no, I think, look, you know, I think, you know, it was a, it was because it was an all Ireland book as well, and I didn't want to make, you know, because I didn't want people thinking, oh, this is a Northern Irish book, this is a Northern Irish editor, or oh, it's all going to be Irish. If you say it's Irish, it's only going to be from the south. So I wanted it to be inclusive, and that's what I did.
Although, ironically enough, June Caldwell, to a certain extent, the Northern Irish / Southern Irish situation arrives in a very small way at the beginning of your essay. Your essay is not about this, although it starts on the 2nd of May 1981. What was happening in Dublin city centre when little 11-year-old June Caldwell, was it the 19 or the 19A from Glasnevin North?
From Glasnevin. It was still Ballymun.
Oh, still Ballymun then, okay.
Yeah, well, this is where the body politic meets body politics, isn't it? Let's face it. And I didn't go overboard on the metaphors of bloodshed and stuff like that, which I was obviously tempted to do. But yeah, I was on the bus on my way into town to Brendan Smith's Academy of Acting. Talk about having notions. And I remember I was so, as it turned out, I was only allowed to go twice, do two terms before they ran out of money to send me again. But anyway, I was on my way in the bus, and it was the first morning that I bled, and the bus came to a halt in O'Connell Street because whoever, the H block protesters had taken over British Home Stores. BHS used to be there in the site of Pennies. And it was just that whole thing of something happening in my body that day that was quite traumatic and strange and very impactful to then this, you know, the troubles in the north coming down to meet us. Because don't forget, you know, we could very handily ignore the troubles, and many people did down south. And then we couldn't when the H block protests were on. And
of course, the Dublin and Monaghan bombings had similarly brought it down here. Yeah.
And we were forced then to face up to what was happening on the island. But for an 11-year-old kid, that was just an absolutely terrifying day. Like, the bus was stopped for about 40 minutes. And there were guys in the top waving weapons around and balaclavas and the whole lot. And I just thought, oh, God, it's very apocalyptic.
Yeah, but that was only one bit of the apocalypse. The real apocalypse was happening, or the post-apocalyptic event was happening within your own body.
Yes.
How provocative, June Caldwell, are you being in the title that you have given to this particular essay, which some people will... It stopped me in my tracks when I saw it on the page. Now, to hear it uttered will stop people in their tracks as well.
Go on, Sean, say it.
No, I couldn't. It's not my word to say, June. It's your word.
It's just a slang word, really, gee pads, which were used as a moniker for sanitary towels back in the day. And it was also a word I was not allowed to use under strict instructions from my mother, because she thought it was the most common word out there. And the fact that it's been just said on national radio is an absolute triumph of Will.
But you can only say it now because, and I don't mean to be in any way flippant about this, but unfortunately you did lose your mother recently.
And I did.
I think in some ways you feel, because what the essay goes on to talk about, it talks in very serious terms, and you know, about the taboo that was around menstruation, about the simplicity of buying a sanitary towel in a shop,
yeah,
you know, in under the counter, into a brown bag and up over the top of the counter without anybody looking, because we couldn't be looking at that and we couldn't be showing that.
Yeah.
That's the taboo that you're talking about here.
Yeah, there was serious taboo issues around it. And also, even for my own mother, she wouldn't allow us to put them in the bin, lest, you know, the dogs get at the bin and people know that there's somebody bleeding in the house, or the filth or the dirt or the shame that was associated. And we had to literally squirrel them away in wardrobes in the house, you know, which wasn't very pleasant, especially when they built up over a month or two. But I won't go into that. But the essay, I hopefully also talks about the society of the time and the politics of the time. And I do bring politics into it, in that there was a tax on tampons at the time that was hastily lifted by Alan Jukes, who was the finance minister. And there was this argument that, you know, you can't call sanitary wear, you know, clothes accessories in the same bracket as hats or jumpers. You know,
it was Mary O'Rourke, I think you say in the essay, who brought this up.
Well, it nearly always takes a woman, doesn't it? Yeah, to point out the obvious. And she was like, you know, all the women on this island will have this, will be bleeding for three or four decades, and we need to do something about this. So the essay does cover politics, and it brings it back around to the kind of teen experience and just the absolute mortification of dealing with this as a teenager in a very repressed society of the time. And for people who couldn't afford, maybe as well, to, you know, keep stocking up, like, you were given one packet and that was it, and you had to make that last. And if you ran out, you did have to use toilet roll and other items that were, you know, stand-ins, like socks.
What would your mother say to you?
She'd probably just kind of laugh. At a late stage in her life, she got very, very tolerant. But this is a woman who, you know, was born in the 30s, lived through the 40s, lived through the war, post-war, lived in a very repressed society in 1950s Ireland. And then, but, you know, she voted for gay marriage before she did leave the world. So, like, you know, the amount of change that she saw in her lifetime was incredible. But yeah, I don't think she'd mind me having a go with this at this stage.
Yeah, she'd let you off with it. I think she probably got used to it at this point in time. Kit, I wanted to talk to you to talk a little bit about what common people, your anthology, what it achieved in what you wanted it to achieve, first of all, and to what extent it achieved this. I think part of your aim very much was to, I suppose, you'd managed to get up, if we want to put it, use a metaphor, you'd get up some ladder into the world of publishing or being published. You didn't want to pull the ladder up behind you. You wanted to leave it there for others and to possibly give them a nudge up onto the first rung.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew nothing about publishing when I got published and when my book came out, which was successful. And I was amazed that there were so many barriers to other people making it. And I just thought it was a great opportunity to be able to do something for other writers that just haven't got the know-how, the networks, an agent. Very often, none of the new writers in Common People had an agent or had any sort of way of getting one. And of course, when you first get published, you don't know, I mean, when you first start writing, you don't know anything about the mechanisms of success. You don't know how to get there and what the steps are. And so for common people, it became a showcase of this fabulous talent that there is untapped in working class communities. And five of the writers have gone on to get book deals. A couple of them are, you know, very good book deals. They've been to literary festivals. And it's definitely started, I wouldn't say started the conversation, because there were people having this conversation before I came along, but it's helped to boost the conversation about who gets published, who gets the breaks, who gets the privileges. So in that regard, it's been very successful. And hopefully it's a movement that's never going to die.
What about in the case of the current anthology then, the 32, which has nothing got to do with any number of counties in any, on any island in these part, this part of the world, Paul McVeigh? Do you have a similar hope, or was there something, do you want it to, was there something different, do you think, that needed to be achieved in this part of the world?
No, I mean, it was definitely the same hope. I mean, this is, you know, totally inspired and sort of a copy of what Kit was doing. And, you know, and I think it's an interesting place here. I mean, I heard people say to me, you know, oh, we don't have class in Ireland. You know, no one's going to say that in England, for example. So I was very interested to hear what people were going to say here. And I do think that the book is different. And there is a sense where class isn't discussed here. I don't think in the same way that it is in England. So there's a really interesting collection here. What I'm loving when I'm rereading and going through it now again is that, you know, we've got voices here, like, you know young writers, 23, talking about stuff that LGBT and being working class and how that affects that, and you know, and then we've got writers in their early 60s coming through for the first time, you know, in their first publication, you know, talking about the history of, you know, and there's like people talking about the inner cities, and then people talking about, you know, the wilds of the countryside, and then you've got the north and south. So you've got this really varied experience. Mm. And obviously there are lots of commonalities, as Kit was saying earlier on, and there's the traditions and things that bring us together as a sort of group. But then there's also these kind of, there's a mixture of stories that make them all individual and all illuminating about just the variety of stories that working class lives that bring to literature, bring to memoir. And hopefully this book shows publishers that we're not just one story. We're not just the working class Irish story that we all know through those famous books. That actually there's a lot of experience, and it varies. And hopefully they will get deals like their English counterparts.
Erin, your essay, as we said, is called Working Class's Authenticity, but it must be a great source of joy to you that it appears just ahead of Roddy Doyle's essay.
Yes,
Which is an essay that you particularly that spoke to you. What was it about? Just explain the idea that it's a kind of a frightening story in some ways when you read the simplicity of it.
Yeah.
Give the essence of what the story Roddy is telling in the essay.
So basically Roddy kind of lays out in the beginning a run-in that he had with a former bank manager at a party or some event that he was at later in life when he'd already become successful. And he's chatting away to the bank manager, and the bank manager thinks it's very funny to recount to him this story of when Roddy's father came into the bank when he was a young man, paying off the last of a loan. And it was nearly as if to say, oh, isn't it gas that, you know, your dad was paying off a loan in the bank, and that you were kind of coming from the likes of that in your working class area, thinking that Roddy Doyle would laugh along and think it was a great gas. And obviously he didn't. But apart from everything else, like, obviously I am so delighted to be featured in anything that Roddy Doyle is also featured in, because I'm sure for a lot of people, as well as me, he's definitely, his works are some of the, you know, first times in my life that I've definitely seen, like, myself represented on screen more than anything else. And I don't even really mean that in any kind of, like, earth-shattering, very profound way. It's just more so, like, seeing people on screen that represent your sense of humour, the way you talk, the way your family interacts with each other, the way your friends interact with each other, seeing all those people reflected in characters. I mean, you really don't. I mean, I didn't get that ever growing up watching, like, American and English TV. I never got kind of a representation of my life and how we interacted with each other. But I definitely, I mean, it's this different side to Roddy, I think, in this, because you get to see, you know, past any of the characters that are obviously so humorous that he normally writes into his own life. And I definitely relate to, you know, him talking about how, you know, in those situations when you have a run-in with somebody who's making a kind of a snap judgment about your background, that you have all these things that you wish you could say, you wish you could take the most eloquent, you know, kind of cutting remark that you can to bring them back down to earth. But of course, it never happens because we're all only human and you're normally struck dumb with these types of things.
But he gives it a great title, though, The Likes of You, which gives us a great pen picture of that manager, that bank manager making the judgment. One essay from you, June, that really stood out.
There's so many, right? I find that really hard. But Finding Words by Teresa Ryder, it just, for a killer opening line alone, my dad died on his hands and knees. There is no great grand statement after that fact. And it just, he died in England. He was one of many immigrants who had to go away to find work. And it just traces the relationship with his illiteracy. It's like the legacy of poverty and what it does to you. And it's absolutely brilliant, beautiful. I cried reading it. You know, it's just so well-rounded, and she brings you through his life and her own life together, and it really is absolutely excellent for the amount of pages that it is. It's like a whole memoir. There are others. There are many others. I think Rosaline McDonough's essay, Nostalgia, is absolutely vital, and I would hope and dream that, that something like that should make it into the curriculum eventually. It's really urgent. I think everybody
should read
it. Just
give us a two-line.
She's on a journey down the country, and she's driving past a traveller's site, and she's remembering all the pains and the joys of growing up as a traveller in Ireland, and it's really, really heartrending stuff, and it's, she's angry writing it, and she's every right to be. It's fantastic.
Final question to you, Kit, and then to you, Paul. What do you think is in the 32 that makes it different from Common People, Kit?
This is going to sound stupid, but it's Irish. So it's got such a feeling for me when I read of the different experience that is Ireland, that the breadth is wider, I think, because in the Common People England, we had very, very little from anyone that lived a rural existence. So this has much more of a flavour of that. Mm. And there is something about, and this again sounds a bit disingenuous, there is something about the poetry of the writing from Ireland. I mean, I was reading June's and I was just laughing all the way through. And I know it's not supposed to be humorous, but it is humorous, and it's beautiful, and it makes period poverty, something that you'd think was a very dry subject, really very moving.
Yeah, well, she gets you with the first line, really, with the title of the essay, she gets you, in fact, in terms of humor. Paul, you're a happy man this evening, I would think, as an editor.
Oh yes, I'm just about to go on the drink there, Sean. As soon as I'm finished this, just to celebrate on my own. I mean, I'm just delighted leaving here and hearing all the writers talk and hearing Kit talk here. It's starting to feel, you know, it feels realer, you know, every time we have a conversation, you know, and when I see it in the bookshops, that's going to be amazing as well. And you know, so I'm just very grateful for the writers that have contributed. Great. And you know, writers like June, you know, I mean, you know, I sought out and convinced to do it because, you know, I think she's just such a unique voice, and I love everything she does, and I think that she looks at the world in ways that that only she can, and that's part of the working class experience as well. I think the book is full of how we see the world, and that's not what you see very often in books.
Lovely to speak with the four of you this evening. We're speaking about the 32, an anthology of working class voices, which is published by Unbound. Thanks to June Caldwell and Aaron Lindsay with us here in studios in Dublin. Kit Duvall joining us from England, and Paul McVeigh joining us from Belfast. The 32, the title of that new anthology. Roxy Music, possibly one of the most uncategorisable musical acts of all time, somehow blending electronic experimentation alongside glam rock, progressive rock, punk and post-punk before post-punk was even a thing, and finally moving on to smooth, jazz-tinged FM cool. They have influenced some of the most significant artists of all those genres, and launching themselves in 1972 with their self-titled debut and continuing with an extraordinary and diverse creative output for a decade or more. Quite a challenge. It's easy to ask the question, but it's quite a challenge to answer the question, where do I begin with in relation to Roxy Music? But that's the challenge we've given to Paul McLoone, who's with me in studio this evening. Uncategorisable It's a hard word to say, and they're a hard band to define, Paul.
They are, Sean, and it's precisely for the reasons that you've just laid out. Just such an astonishing, dizzying collage of styles and influences, and not just from within music, but also the whole Warhol-esque kind of pop art dimension to it, the retro-futurism, all coming together with just a tremendous degree of musicianship. And of course, in the early days, the Eno factor as well, which was just completely off the wall. I mean, he's coming from the kind of Stockhausen experimental hard edge of electronics. So the whole thing...
Just lay out that early band, if you like. The kind of the starting point when the two Brians were still... talking nicely to each other.
Yeah, the two Brians. Yeah, we'll probably come to that. But it wasn't initially him. He got brought in. Andy Mackay brought Eno in. Andy Mackay owned the synthesizer that Eno was seen playing, famously, that huge synthesizer on Old Grey Whistle Test that looks like a telephone switchboard. I think Mackay actually owned that, but Eno could work it. Mackay was more of a classical guy, and he played an oboe, of course, which in terms of a rock band was a fairly unusual thing for any period, never mind the early 70s at the dawn of glam rock. So they came in, initially Brian Ferry, of course, who was the real creative mover and shaker, despite the tremendous musicianship of his various collaborators out through the years. It was really very much his vehicle. And he had initially assembled a completely different lineup. There were a couple of guitarists before the great Phil Manzanera eventually joined. You know, he was initially just a roadie for the band. And then the guy that they had, a gentleman by the name of David O'List, who was a guitarist of some pedigree on the rock scene in the UK of that time. But he became increasingly disenchanted with the whole thing, and the feeling was mutual. And one day they just invited Phil Manzanera to join the band. He thought he was just helping them set up, and in fact he was being auditioned. So that's when that great initial lineup, the Eno inclusive lineup, came together. Paul Thompson on the drums, of course, as well, often overlooked, but a terrific drummer, one of those real powerhouse kind of drummers. And without him, I think the thing, and in fact, I know, because without him, the thing didn't quite have the kind of punch and the precision and the impact that actually really tied all those disparate sort of elements together.
Now, your starting point for us is, in fact, a kind of a starting point of your own with Roxy Music. It's a little bit further into their life. Not too much further in, but a bit further in.
It is. It's towards, I guess, getting towards the end of the 70s, really. The album Manifesto from 1979. And it was my first personal encounter. Well, I realised later it wasn't my first actual encounter, but at the time I didn't quite realise that I had seen them before, but they just looked so different. And when I saw Brian Ferry, particularly with Roxy Music, in these very sharp, silky-looking suits on top of the Pops doing Dance Away, I genuinely thought he was drunk. I mean, I was 12, you know, but I'm looking at the TV going, this guy's drunk. And of course, I thought this was great. I was going, he's drunk, he's on Top of the Pops, because of all the eye fluttering and the lip twitching and the kind of swaying. And he was really playing up to that whole louche kind of romantic outsider persona, which at this point I think had actually taken him over. It had actually kind of engulfed him. At the beginning, I think it was a kind of a pose, a kind of a character he was playing. Then the lifestyle had actually begun to very much mirror that type. He became that type of guy. And this is him at the absolute height of that. And it was my first reintroduction to Roxy and one of their great, great hit singles, Dance Away. You're dressed to kill and guess who's dying.
There we go. Dance Away from the 1979 album Manifesto, where Paul McLoone is suggesting we start with Roxy Music. But as you were saying to me as we were listening to that, Paul, for some people, that's kind of the beginning of the end of Roxy Music.
For the purists, because Roxy took 4 years off when they were reaching something in terms of their success, certainly at the height of their powers in 1975. Eno was long gone by this stage. He'd been replaced by a guy called Eddie Jobson, who had a something of a pedigree in the progressive rock scene in the UK at the time. He'd been in Curved Air, he worked with Jethro Tull, he worked with Yes. So he was on board for three albums, along with a guy called John Gustafson on bass. So a lot of people would say that was kind of the middle incarnation of Roxy Music. Then they took 4 years off. Brian Ferry's solo career by this stage had really taken flight. He seemed to be very much focused on that at the expense of the band, perhaps. And he went off and did that for a while. And then Roxy Music reconvened with the Manifesto album. It's a good album, to paraphrase someone may be familiar. It's a good album. It's just not a great album. It's fine. It just lacks a certain magic that was present in the five classic albums that they made up until 1975. Still a fine record and brilliant, brilliant stuff to be found on it. And among it, Dance Away. And as I say, that was my kind of my first conscious introduction to the band. And then I realised that's the same guy. Much later I realised that's the same. I remember him in the leopard skin and the quiff. A very different Brian Ferry. And for the purists, perhaps a slightly less interesting, slightly less compelling incarnation of Brian Ferry and the band.
So let's go back then to the earlier guy that you hadn't kind of fully reckoned. And when was this just in Stranded in 1973, that album? Was Eno was gone at this stage?
Eno has departed by this stage. Ironically, it is Eno's, he's on the records several different places in interviews as citing Stranded as his favourite Roxy Music album, which is either very generous or very tricky of him, depending on what way you want to look at it. Eno was gone. I think there was the inevitable tension that develops between two such strong focal points in a band. And I think you can't have two front men, or it's very hard to make that work. Or as Brian Ferry slightly more bitchily put it, there's only room for one non-musician in Roxy Music. And, you know, there was an inevitable tension there. I also think, though, despite the fact that people play up the jealousy that possibly emanated from Ferry around the attention that Eno was getting, I'm sure that was there. I'm sure he's an eminently egotistical man. Mm. But I think if you actually look at where Eno went musically after his departure from Roxy Music, things came to a head, apparently, at the York Festival in 1973, when the crowd all started chanting Eno, 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 and tensions really boiled up after that, resulting with Eno walking out of the band. But if you look at where he went musically then in his own career, it was very much on a different path that Ferry was clearly taking Roxy Music. They're so completely divergent. So I think it's possible.
Were they two alike or were they two different? You know, there's only one letter in the difference in the names, the Y and an I, Brian and Brian.
Brian with an I think was genuinely more of the experimental artist than Brian with a Y. Brian with a Y, who had an equally arty, modern art, pop art kind of background to Eno. I think he's just had a slightly more, I guess, conventional music sensibility when it came right down to it, whereas Eno was really about making things sound utterly different to what had come before. He was such a complete modernist in terms of his early solo output. It really sounded like nothing else, and he was about really challenging the accepted order of things. Funnily enough, members of Roxy Music played on the albums of both the solo albums of Brian Ferry and Brian Eno, so they were maybe the kind of peacemakers between the two around that time.
But despite the fact that Eno was gone and that he did go on to have the stellar career that he did
as a producer as well, of course.
Exactly. Yeah. Mother of Pearl from Stranded in 1973 kind of proves that Brian with a Y could manage okay.
He absolutely could, and he is occasionally undervalued as a lyricist, I think. The image, like I said earlier, the image, which originally was a kind of a concocted thing, I think it sort of started to become very dominant, and it became very easy to kind of dismiss him. I think the press turned on him a little. I can't remember which music journalist it was, Melody Maker, NME, one of those guys rechristened him Byron Ferrari, you know, and there was a certain caricature that was developing. But that shouldn't blind us to the fact that lyrically he was just an absolute genius at this point. Turn up the music.
That's Mother of Pearl from the 1973 album from Roxy Music, Stranded, and Paul McLoone with me in studio this evening giving us some guidance as to where we might begin with Roxy Music. We started with Dance Away, we went to Mother of Pearl there, which is kind of a kind of swampy rock type of feel to it as much as anything else. Paul,
yes, but in the verses there's just this amazing cascade of lyrics. I think they're absolutely unmatched in his in his entire canon, actually. In my opinion, it's just such a sustained tour de force of imagery and classic kind of fairy smartass conceits that he gets away with. It just stuns me still. There's so many ideas that he puts into a 5-minute song. So I would urge listeners who aren't familiar with it to check out the full length version of that. You'll find it on the Stranded album, Mother of Pearl. It's just a jaw dropping achievement lyrically.
6:53, nearly 7 minutes, yes. As you say. You saw them in 2006 in Dublin. What was the state of play of the band at that point? Because they're not quite old men at this stage, but they're certainly getting along.
They're getting up there. They'd reformed for a few years by that stage, and I'd actually been lucky enough to see them on a couple of occasions before that. The Vicar Street show, though, I think, because it was an intimate venue by their standards, and indoors, and just a chance to see these legends, at least most of them, up close and personal doing their thing. And what was impressive about it was they didn't kind of just play the hits, and they didn't just focus on the more commercial, more conventional end of the career stuff, which they could easily have done and probably would have been forgiven for doing so, because that was closer to where they were then. They went right back to the beginning. They were very keen, or at least Ferry, I would imagine it was him that was driving this, was very keen to present an entire history of the band, warts and all, the more difficult stuff. And it was interesting watching the different factions of the audience reacting to different songs. They've got a 10-minute song on the second album, For Your Pleasures, called The Bogus Man. And it is, if you're not ready for 10 minutes of a kind of a can sound alike, there's only really one chord in it, and it's this sort of menacing, threatening kind of Sprechsang thing. If you're not ready for that, you're expecting more than this, you're probably going to get a shock. And it was interesting watching some of the elements of the audience just
What? We're going to go back to the early album just to finish up, the self-titled debut, and their mission statement, if you like, in Remake, Remodel. But before we do that, we should mention Avalon, which is vital.
Yes, Avalon was worth the wait. A couple of okay but not fantastic albums in Manifesto and Flesh and Blood. Great singles, though. Always great singles. And then Avalon comes along, and just a wonderfully elegant swan song for a band. The album, and particularly the title track, with that wonderfully jaded opening line, "Now the party's over, I'm so tired." And it was just less of a bang, but more of a sophisticated sigh than a whimper, I think. Just a beautiful, beautiful way to go out.
But I will finish with Remake, Remodel, which this is the ultimate mission statement, is it? 1972.
It really threw down the calling card. Yeah, early doors with the debut album, and it's just such a wonderful postmodernist kind of thing. I mean, the chorus is actually literally a car registration number, CPL 593A. And then right at the end of the song, the band, it's so kind of impertinent, really. The band just kind of go through this potted history of music, everybody from Wagner right through to the Beatles. And it's just said, this is what Roxy Music is. And it does it in a really punky way, which is always a good thing.
Great to have you in, Paul. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me in. Really enjoyed it.
Remake, Remodel from the 1972 debut album, self-titled debut album from Roxy Music. Paul McLoone answering the question, where do I begin with Roxy Music for us this evening? A new film and stage collaboration between Laura Sheehan and Little John Nee, Drone Bone Jetty, is set in a not too distant dystopian future in the west of Ireland. The imagined future sees art without artists as the new reality. Working through the pandemic, Little John and Laura developed the piece online, and they've devised a format which includes performance pieces as well as sections shot in Connemara and other locations around the country. Delighted to have Little John Nee and Laura Sheehan join me on the line this evening. You wrote the piece here as well as everything else, Little John, as well as performing in a Drone Bone Jetty. We're in a dystopian future. Artificial intelligence is creating art through algorithms. It's a frightening prospect, but given what we've just been through with the pandemic, anything could happen really in the next while, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the interesting things, was when I'd done the first draft of the script, the pandemic hadn't started yet. And all of a sudden, the script wasn't that shocking at all. Do you know? I'd been overtaken by the dystopian future that we actually live in, you know? Yeah. And so we had to rewrite it all. Yeah.
And I guess in some ways, you know, obviously we still have people, whether it's a Zoom performance or it's a film performance, we still have people actually performing for us. But you are actually heading towards a situation, or we are writing about it here, a situation where perhaps the artist is rendered absolutely defunct, useless. They're nothing other than a place where data can be gathered.
Yeah, yeah. The Academy of Holodramatic Art is where the central character Puck gets a job. And at the Academy, it's famous for their Irish collection, where they've done a whole the Irish classics, including Playboy of the Western World with Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor. And they were just holograms, obviously. But they had to map it out. So they used actors to map it out.
Yeah.
You know, and then they imposed Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor onto them. So it's a whole series of that. But Puck Turrell is one of the second group, the idiosyncratics. Once the great artists of the locale have all been harvested, they're looking for the quirky ones, the idiosyncratics, the mess ups, the bad actors.
Yeah,
and that's where Puck gets his in. And Puck, to his surprise at the time.
Yeah, Puck is your character, and I might come back to that specific name in a moment because you didn't name him Puck by accident, I would guess. But let's listen to a little section. This is where Puck is the whole process of what's involved in the Unity and the Academy of Holodramatic Art is being explained to him in this section, and it's you, Little John, obviously performing.
She explained the first wave was where the skills of good artists were absorbed into the Unity. It was called ghosting. Like actors would perform Playboy to Western World, the Unity codifies their moves, then replaces them in the holodrama We Dead Stars. There's a whole series of Irish classics. Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor. People come out of the theatres raving about how they nailed the Irish accents. When all the classics were done, from Shakespeare to Beckett, the actors began working on new plays written by the Unity. And finally, in improvisations. Data drained, data duplicated, data mapped, and the code fed into sequencers. The Unity holograms can improvise better than most actors. Same went for writers and composers. Art without artists, because the Unity does it better.
That's Little John Nee performing in his own show, Drone Bone Jetty, and describing a life where there is art without artists. Laura Sheeran, you're the director of the piece. Will directors survive this cull? How are you doing, Laura? Will directors survive this cull, do you think, or will they be subject to the same type of data harvesting that poor performers will be?
No, yes. Nobody is safe.
Laura,
absolutely nobody is safe.
Yeah, you saw this piece and started speaking to Little John, I suppose, at a point where you hope this might go into a theatre and actually be performed live in front of an audience, real people sitting in real seats. How much did you start to reconceive the piece with them when you realised, no, this is going to have to be a totally different format? Was there much involved in the changes and how involved were you in those discussions with Little John?
Well, at the very start, it was the story, I suppose, that Little John approached me with, and he initially was just telling me, you know, what he had been working on, and I really just believed in the piece, you know. And at that time, the original idea was definitely to work towards putting together a show for the stage. But while we were in the process of, you know, over and back on Zoom, trying to work out how to make it happen, the different lockdowns were coming and going, and the frustration really was in trying, remaining attached to the original idea. And then as soon as we decided to just completely change the plan and move more towards video, everything kind of opened up. And so in that way, it was quite easy. But of course, you know, there's no template for any of this. So we definitely were kind of just, I suppose, just taking it one step at a time and just seeing how, I suppose everything was just a bit of an experiment.
And we
just leaned into what was working. And, you know, whatever wasn't working, we kind of just moved away from, I suppose. And we naturally found the organic path for the piece to be completed.
What about that character name then, Little John? Puck Tyrrell. Puck, of course, one of the characters in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Was that part of the thinking? Does he relate to that character in some way?
Yeah, well, he relates to a lot of the Puck mythology. And there was a picture that I had in my head as well of Charlie Chaplin, in that sense of the pan figure as well, you know, the bottom half totally attached to the earth and the top half aspiring to the heavens. So that's kind of my interpretation of it then. And then there was all these little accidents happened. For example, part of the costume designer, who was really amazing, Ilaria Pelizzaro, the designer, she came up with a costume that was very Japanese inspired, and the shoes were these kind of like hooved, the Japanese shoes. Obviously the toes are separate from the rest of the foot, but they give the appearance of these hooved feet, you know. So there's lots of little things, little resonances and echoes.
Would you still have a hope, Little John, that this might have an actual life in the theatre itself, or are you happy that it's found its place now? Because it is a wonderful expression of this kind of idea of artificial intelligence. It works on film in a peculiar type of way.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to go back and really rework it again. Yeah. I just have to take this opportunity to say it's a real privilege to work with Laura Sheeran, who is a pure genius. And I mean, it's as much her show as mine, you know. She took it and she out-punked me in the sense of I thought I was punk, you know. But, you know, and it's, you know, it's, we went with it because we knew it had to get made. We wanted to tell the story. But she had the ability to film it, not only direct it, but film it and edit it, do the camera work and everything, you know.
Out-punked. That's quite a compliment, Laura.
I'm not on the call anymore.
Well, listen, thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. That's Little John Lee, Laura Sheeran. And Drone Bone Jetty will be screened at Century Cinemas in Letterkenny on Wednesday the 21st of July as part of the Errigal Arts Festival. And you can find out full details on eaf.ie. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7 once again here on RT Radio 1.